why would someone enlist in the military at the age of 58? This hour, why at that age, Dan Grinstead joined the Iowa Army National Guard and deployed to Afghanistan. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Captain Dan Grinstead is one of Iowa's notable veterans whose portraits are part of a new exhibit at the Iowa Gold Star Museum at Camp Dodge. We'll talk with him and also talk with exhibit photographer Bill Schaefer. Then in the second half hour, our brains, how they work, how they grow, how they age, how they can recover from injury or disease, and what we can do to keep them healthy. My conversation with Dr. Michael Merzenich, a pioneer in the study of brain plasticity. That's all coming up right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A new photo exhibit called the Notable Iowan Veteran Project has opened that honors living Iowa veterans, and it's at the Gold Star Museum at Camp Dodge. This first half hour, we'll focus on that exhibit with the exhibit photographer. Bill Schaefer is with us, a professor of photography emeritus at Grandview University. Bill, in our Des Moines studio, hi.
Hi, Ben. Glad to be here.
Great to have you with us. Also joining us, one of the people in the exhibit, Captain Dan Grinstead of the Iowa Army National Guard. Captain Grinstead, welcome.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Well, let's talk first, Bill, about this exhibit. It's your brainchild. You are also a veteran, I understand. For this exhibit, you photographed prominent Iowans who have a military background, prominent living Iowans. How did you get this idea?
It goes back to 1939 when I was born. I remember World War II as a young child, and in college I took a very good class from a professor who was a World War II veteran. I retired from teaching photography at Grandview, and I moved to Clark County, or I spent a lot of time in Clark County where I had built a cabin over the 20 years before. And I started to meet these old World War II vets. So in 2011, I found and photographed all 43 living World War II veterans in Clark County. And that was an exhibit at the Gold Star and a number of other places. Mm-hmm. I kind of rolled right into this next project of photographing notable Iowa veterans. I'd known Bob Ray for years since I came to Iowa in 79, and Governor Ray was 46, 47 in the Army and the Japanese occupation. So I saw him in January, and I said, Governor, I'd like to come over and photograph you. I know you have a photo of yourself in uniform. And then it just went on to other people.
Mm-hmm. A lot of notable people. Of course, that's what the exhibit is about. Simon Estes here. He was the opera singer, was a National Guard member from Centerville, Iowa. Terry Branstad, the Army MP. Leonard Boswell, a helicopter pilot in Vietnam. How did you get this idea that it would be nice, and it is very effective, to have them hold their photographs of a younger version of themselves in military uniform?
That went back to almost the first World War II vet in Clark County, Iowa. I had made an appointment with this man. He was a survivor of 9 landings in the Pacific. He was an Army engineer. And I went over to his house, and he had a flag on the wall, and I said, Adrian, it'd be a good idea maybe to stand in front of that flag. And he said, I've got some medals. He held those, and I thought, that's fine. And I said, you have a picture there on the piano when you were in uniform. He said, oh, yeah. So he held that one. Well, as soon as we saw that with the flag in the background and his young photo in uniform with himself holding it then, that's where everything fell into place.
Wow. So you immediately saw the appeal of that. Did all veterans you photographed, did they react the same way? Were they comfortable doing that?
Well, the World War II veterans in Clark County were not as comfortable. Those people range from 84 to 100 years old, and I had to convince them that this was a legitimate project and that there was, you know, this was a history project. Mm-hmm. And so neighbors and the American Legion in Osceola, Iowa, and Clark County helped with that. But they all did manage to find a photograph of themselves in uniform, which is quite amazing because I was a vet. I was in the 311th General Hospital in 1957 for 6 years in Minot, North Dakota, and I cannot find my picture taken at the end of my basic training. So they all managed.
Mm-hmm. And you know one exists.
Pardon?
You know one of your photographs exists, a photograph of you, but you just can't find it, huh?
No, the library at Fort Leonard Wood is looking high and low for me.
Hopefully they will find it. Yeah. Captain Dan Grinstead, you are in this photo exhibit tell us, how was the experience for you holding your photograph? Was that...
Well, it was a wonderful experience. My photo is quite different from everybody else's because my story is a little bit different from everybody else's.
Right.
So in my photo, I'm wearing my uniform because I did not join the Army Guard until quite a late age. So the photo I'm holding is me at age 22. Where everybody else's photo they're holding is them in uniform, and me, I'm in my civilian clothes.
Hey, well, so you actually picked an early you. Let's get people up to speed on your story. You enlisted at the age of 57 at the Iowa Army National Guard. That's when that process started.
That's when it started. Yes.
Why? Why do that at the age of 57?
Well,
something you've been thinking about for a long time?
It had been something that I had been thinking about. And what started it was something like this. I'm a social worker, and in my middle 50s, I began to notice and became concerned about the number of soldiers coming home with behavioral health problems. And it occurred to me at the time that with the skill set that I had, I should do something about that. And then I thought, what was the best way to do that? And it coincidentally, one of the physicians that I worked with at university hospitals was in the Guard, and he would come back to work after guard duty on the weekend and say, "Dan, we need behavioral health officers." And I would just laugh at him at the time. I say, "You know, I'm too old. I'm in my 50s. There's no way this is going to happen." And he told me about the process that I needed to go through, and it just seemed to me the conclusion was, in order to work with soldiers, the most respectful way to do that for me was to put the uniform on. And fortunately, I found a recruiter who would come and talk to me, and that started the whole process off.
Mm-hmm. And they welcomed you right from the get-go, even with your age?
They did. The recruiter, Major Matt Dial, I'll never forget. He came into the office, and about 2 minutes into the conversation, he said to me, "You know, you'd look pretty good in a uniform."
Probably not the first time he's used that line.
I would guess not.
You spent many months, 9 months, I think, in Afghanistan, November 2010 through July 2011. Tell me about the work there, because here in civilian life, you're, as you mentioned, a social work specialist. You're at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. At work at an inpatient psychiatry unit. So your work there was what? Who did you help?
The work there was similar in that I worked in a combat stress clinic, both at Bagram Airfield and later on at a forward operating base called Meterlam. And the people that I worked with were all soldiers of any branch. And the problems that we dealt with were very similar to the problems that we would have at home, separation from family, complicated by the fact that we were all in an unsafe environment, and it could be at any time and any day in any place that our friends could be killed or injured severely.
Mm-hmm. So did you feel stressed? Because what made you feel that it was unsafe? Were there indications? What was going on?
There was very clear indications. We were only at Bagram Airfield 1 or 2 days before we experienced our first incoming indirect fire. We were rocketed. And that first night that we were rocketed, 4 or 5 rockets hit the base, and they have a loudspeaker system called the Big Voice. The Big Voice comes on and tells us to take shelter and don our protective gear, and then they set off a siren. And, of course, being Iowa boys, when we hear a siren, our first response is to run outside and look for the tornado, which was actually the opposite thing we should have done. But, you know, we're conditioned to that when we hear sirens here in Iowa.
Bill Schaefer, you photographed a number of notable Iowans who have military backgrounds. Dan just spoke of the stress of combat, being in that kind of theater, too. I wonder if you talked with the veterans you photographed for this exhibit about their service while you were photographing them.
I did with a number of them, as many as I could. Sometimes these pictures would take 10, 15 minutes after I was set up because these are busy people. But most veterans are willing to talk and knew that this is an interesting, valuable project. I kept stressing this is a history project. So, yes, I did talk to quite a few of them. I think one of the more interesting veterans was the longest-serving POW during the Vietnam War, held in, the Hanoi Hilton of the North Vietnam. His name is Commander Larry Spencer, and he was an airman, and he and his pilot were shot down, I'm thinking 1966 or 67, over North Vietnam. The pilot did not survive. Commander Spencer did. He was captured. He was put into the Hanoi Hilton, and I don't think he was released until 73, 7 years minus 6 days. To talk about, to listen to his experiences are just something else.
I imagine. Any other favorites you point to? I mean, they're, of course, it goes without saying, they're all favorites. They're part of this this collection. I notice you have one of the original Tuskegee Airmen from World War II in this exhibit.
Yes, Dr. James Bowman, who was assistant superintendent of schools for years in Des Moines, he was a Tuskegee Airman. There were somehow something like 900 of these people, and he's the last surviving one in Iowa. I specifically looked for, worked real hard to get a Tuskegee Airman, and fortunately we had one. I did not have a chance to talk to him too much about his experiences. The only thing I know is that he was not assigned combat role in Europe. He stayed in the States, United States, but he did have to bail out over the swamps in Alabama when something happened to his plane, but he was an interesting one.
Bill Schaefer is with us. If you just joined us, he's an exhibit photographer. He came up with the idea of this notable Iowan veteran project. It's a new photo exhibit that's open to honors living Iowa veterans, notable Iowans. It's at the Gold Star Museum at Camp Dodge. Along with Bill, we have Captain Dan Grinstead of the Iowa Army National Guard featured in this exhibit with an unusual path to the military, that path only starting in his late 50s. Bill Schaefer, why did you pick Dan Grinstead for this exhibit?
This is an interesting story. I've dedicated this notable Iowa veterans exhibit to my brother-in-law, Bob Corbett, who lives in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in Vietnam in 69 and 70 with the 25th Infantry Division on a mountain that was called the Black Virgin. And it was a year of extreme fighting and stress, and many people did not survive. Now in his mid-60s, he has health problems, and I dedicated it to him. So that is I forgot the original question that you asked me.
Why you picked Dan Grinstead?
Yes. Okay. So Dan was scheduled to talk on a program in May, early May, put on by the Veterans Administration by Mardell Barnes, Marty Barnes. And her father's one of the notables that I photographed because he was in World War II and Korea, and he also been on General Douglas MacArthur's staff during the Japanese occupation. I found out about her program, and I begged to be allowed to come, even though it was mostly for professionals in the helping field. And Dan was one of the presenters there, and I was just amazed in an hour and a half presentation with his photographs and his talk and everything like he'd done that. Mm-hmm. I thought, I need to photograph this man.
Mm-hmm. 9 months you spent, Dan Grinstead, in Afghanistan as part of the Iowa Army National Guard deployment there. You talked about being rocketed, about feeling unsafe, and about treating people as a social worker who were under the stresses of this combat zone. How do you, how does that stress exhibit itself, and how do you as a social worker help people cope with it?
the number one way that the stress exhibited itself and the number one reason soldiers came to see me was for lack of sleep. That was the ticket in the door, and that would be a pretty non-threatening way to begin a discussion with anybody. And so we would use that opening to say, well, in addition to sleep, what else is going on that may be bothering you? And it could be anything from things going on at home that they had no control about, things that they were worried about, to, of course, life in Afghanistan itself.
Mm-hmm. So when the problems were outed, how did you deal with them? Are there tricks or methods of coping?
Well, I don't know if there's any tricks, but a lot of it would be that we were willing to listen to what soldiers had to say and discuss that, and we would get into active problem solving with them as quickly as we could to try to give them ideas about how they might control their reactions to certain situations and come out the other side being a better person.
I wonder if you think, given that your age, you're much older than the average soldier in Afghanistan, if that was a different perspective you could give to them, and your presence of being in sort of an elder soldier helped.
Right. Absolutely. I was 60 when I deployed, and I firmly believe that being that age gave me a great advantage in talking to the soldiers.
How?
Because, you know, I'd been there and done that, and you know, a lot of the life experiences that they were discussing, we could try to put that in a different perspective so they could frame it up in a positive kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Did you come back even at this late date of deployment in your life, later than most, a changed person by these 9 months?
Oh, absolutely changed. I feel it's my mission now to right some wrongs that I feel that are out there. One in particular, and Bill may have heard me say this before, is that when we were in college, when I was in social work school, it would have been impossible for a veteran to come talk to us. It just wouldn't have happened, wouldn't have been possible. And now I've had many opportunities to return to Wartburg, where I went to school, and Buena Vista University, to talk to social work students and say to them, listen, you have to understand that people in the military, you have to think about us as being a member of a different culture.
And is this because it was the Vietnam and post-Vietnam era that was impossible?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. We weren't enlightened. We didn't think about the soldiers and the needs that they might have had at that time, and we ignored them, and I think we need to change that.
You see it that way too, Bill Schaefer?
Yes. I had my service out of the way by the time Vietnam really got heated up. I was going to graduate school at Indiana University, and then I had a job in Canada for 2 years. I pretty much ignored it. The university was shut down sometimes, and I know I was frustrated. I just wanted to go to class and finish my doctorate back then. We just kind of pushed it aside. And all of a sudden, I hear these stories from Vietnam veterans. I see my brother-in-law. One of the stories I just heard from one of our Iowa notables was Bob Conley from Des Moines, who was also deployed on this Black Virgin Mountain about the same time that my brother-in-law was, and he was in the 1st Division. I think the 1st Division was on the bottom and the 25th Division on the top. He said he left Vietnam, and within 20 hours he was in San Francisco on a plane. He had his ticket all the way to Des Moines. He called his family there, and he said, I'm coming on such and such a date. He got to Omaha, and he got basically put off the plane, kicked off, because somebody, a businessman or somebody, had a first-class ticket. Mm. And he didn't know how he was going to get to Des Moines, no way to talk to his parents and tell the difference. And the heart-rending part of that story was that his father stood out there for something like 12 hours and met every single plane on the tarmac until Bob Conley finally got back to Des Moines. I mean, that was so typical, I think, of how we treated Vietnam vets, right from the war, right home, nothing in between, no respect.
So you see, Dan Grinstead, as a social worker, our culture's really changed for the better here, tremendously.
Exactly, and let me just tell you another anecdotal story. When I was coming home on leave, we flew through Dallas-Fort Worth, and this was a military charter. And when we get off the plane, the group of us, about 300, were walking through the terminal, and people would stop and applaud as we walked through. It was just incredible. And then there were many people to greet us, airport greeters at Dallas-Fort Worth. So I can't imagine what it must have been like for our Vietnam vets to come home, because for us it was just remarkable.
What do you want to achieve with this exhibit, Bill Schaefer?
From the first day that I thought of doing a photography project on veterans, I conceived of it as a history project. And the idea of having these pictures blown up real big and hanging in various venues really didn't occur to me. And that's still my number one priority. I see that these photographs I'm taking are more about the future than the present.
Oh, how do you mean that?
Well, I think that I'm creating, let's say, a visual time capsule that can be opened in 50, 100, 200 years from now. I plan to work really hard to put all these photos and the stories on DVDs and just deposit them anywhere I can. Library of Congress, the World War II Museum in New Orleans, the Pritzker Military Library, the Iowa State Historical Society, so that these are history, and I'm doing a history project. I guess I'm a frustrated historian.
It sounds to me like it's not only the history that you're looking at and for the future, but there's a lot of healing going on here. Something going on here that we're talking about, Dan Grinstead, that is bigger than history or the future.
That's right. The healing continues, and the way I look at it, my mission continues. Even though I'm home now, I feel driven to tell our story. It's not just me. It's our story. There were 2,700 of us from Iowa who deployed, and unfortunately, four of us didn't come back. And so this is our story.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, before we have to go, Bill Schaefer, what's next for you? Where do you turn your lens now?
This project isn't over. I will continue to find notables, and I'm soliciting ideas, names from other people. People who maybe aren't so well known. I've taken a lot of well known people now, but people who, for one reason or another, have a military background and are making a difference in Iowa. So I will continue the project at a slower pace. I'm supposed to be retired, but that's what I'm looking forward to doing.
Bill Schaefer, thank you very much. The photographer, new photo exhibit called The Notable Iowan Veteran Project. It opened at the Gold Star Museum at Camp Dodge, honoring living notable Iowa veterans. And one of them joined us in the exhibit, Captain Dan Grinstead. And Bill Schaefer, thank you for your service.
You're welcome.
Of course. And thank you for joining us this half hour with your insights. Coming up in just a moment in our second half hour, it's all about our brains, how they work, how they grow, how they age, how they can recover from injury or disease, and what we can do to keep them healthy. Conversation with Dr. Michael Merzenich. He's a pioneer in the study of brain plasticity. What's that, brain plasticity, you say? You'll find out if you stay with us after this break. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this half hour is all about our brains, how they work, how they grow, how they age, how they can recover from injury or disease, and what we can do to keep them healthy. My guest is Dr. Michael Merzenich. He's one of the foremost researchers of something called neuroplasticity. I'll explain what that is in just a moment. Merzenich's work has shown that the brain retains its ability to alter itself well into adulthood, and this suggests that brains with injuries or disease might be able to recover function even later in life. Merzenich has also explored the way The senses are mapped into the regions of the brain and the way sensations teach the brain to recognize new patterns. Dr. Michael Mrzenik, welcome to our program.
Hi, Ben. It's nice to be with you.
We want to mention tonight you'll be speaking at Iowa State University at the Great Hall, in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union at 8 p.m. You'll be talking about some of the things we're talking about today, rewiring the brain. Let's start off, if we could, by having you tell us how you like to describe neuroplasticity, brain plasticity.
Well, Ben, not too many years ago, the predominant belief was that the brain basically became hardwired relatively early in life. That is to say that it was plastic. It could change in a young child, but at a very early age, mostly before you actually entered the schoolhouse door, it matured into a fixed or hardwired form. And from that point forward, it was like a computer on your desk, where every element in the computer, every wire, had its lifelong function. And we now know that that's completely wrong. We now know that the brain is continually remodeling itself. It's continually changing its wiring. Every time you learn a new skill or ability or acquire new understanding or new capability, you're actually changing the physical brain. You're changing the functional brain. Mm-hmm. In a sense, you're creating a new brain. And the brain is specializing in ways that accounts for all of the things that you can do or can't do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you say the way we used to talk about it, and
right.
Also in the way we used to talk about it, and we still do talk, we are amazed at babies' brains, how they learn, how they develop so quickly,
right.
and how we tend to think as we get older that our brains lose that ability to learn things and decline in function. So what is the difference between a baby or a child's brain and an adult's brain that plasticity?
Well, when you're a baby, you could say the brain is taking in information like a sponge, and the changes that occur are largely unregulated. And what happens across the development is the brain actually learns to control its own change. And it only permits change when it's older. You could say when the brain judges the change to be good for it, or you could say it advantages it. The brain actually is controlling its own changing.
Give me an example of controlling its own change.
Well, when you're working at any skill or ability, when you're trying to master some skill or ability, the brain is evaluating the success of the attempt, you could say, and it's only allowing change when it judges the attempt to be a good one. That would be an example. So it's actually progressively changing its wiring, you could say, to advantage it to accomplish the mastery of the task. And you learn any new skill. Let's say I'm playing at the game of ping pong, and initially I'm clumsy and inaccurate, and I'm inaccurate in how I'm taking in information from my eyes or controlling my hands. But every time you succeed, the brain basically rewards itself, and it says, save that information, save those connections that just accounted for that good moment of play. You do that thousands of times, and ultimately the brain has created a master controller. Mm-hmm. And it's made you, given you a ping pong player brain, you could say. You didn't have it before you started to play.
But do you say then that we do that less well as we age, ping pong or learn a new language?
Well, actually, this is with you for life, Ben. You know that you can learn a new ability or you can improve it at that ability if you really work at it at any age. But it is attenuated in most older individuals because we are not learning as much, you're not engaging this machinery enough, and then you're also bearing the weight of experience, which is tending to constrain you in your new learning abilities. But the basic processes of brain change are with you as long as you're on the planet.
So you're saying these things like, oh, it's too old for me to learn how to play a violin or a guitar, or too old for me to learn Japanese or something like that. That's just false.
It is false. You know, you do bear the weight of experience in taking up something as adventuresome as Japanese when you're 80, let's say. But you could learn. You will learn to a certain extent. Your brain still has the capacity to learn. You can make progress down that path, mm-hmm. And you know that. You know, you might not get past the squeaks and squawks very far in the violin, but you sure can make progress from ground zero.
Okay.
And that. The progress you make is accounted for by brain change, by brain remodeling.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Nevertheless, our brains do deteriorate, right? In what ways does our brain change and deteriorate with age?
They do deteriorate for sure. And you reach the peak in the performance ability of the brain as a machine on the statistical average when you're in your 20s or 30s. And, of course, there are many exceptions to that. Many people hang in there much longer. some to near the end of life, but mostly we begin to deteriorate in our 20s or 30s. Then we slowly decline. The brain slows down in its operations. It becomes less precise, less organized, and so forth. But actually, you can do a lot to forestall those changes. You can do a lot to maintain high functionality even into older age.
Mm-hmm. So when you see, and there are over many thousands of very sharp centenarians in the country,
yeah.
in Iowa also. So are
you're famous for those, Ben, you know. Those.
Yeah, Iowa. You're saying Iowa, right?
Yeah, Iowa, okay. Sure, absolutely.
Okay. Now, what makes a difference there? How do we create really sharp centenarians with great memories and agile minds?
Well, one of the keys is to remain connected to the details of life as you drink them in. I mean, one of the things that occurs in a modern life, and maybe you can escape this more in Iowa than in the average place that you live in, is you become removed from the details of operations and vision or listening. You're not really connected with the real world anymore. You work you operate neurologically in a kind of never-never land of abstraction.
Mm.
And, you know, a lot of ways that we've changed the physical environment that we live in favors that, to be removed from really smelling the flower or looking at the details of what we're seeing in front of us or really listening.
And you're saying that's not good to be removed.
That's not good. It's not good to have every footfall on the ground be predictable, reliable, something that could be done unconsciously. You know, walking across the field and have every footfall be uncertain is healthier for your brain. In a variety of ways, we change the way we live, the way we operate, to remove the surprises from life and to remove us from drinking in the details that sustain our refined vision, our refined hearing, our refined sensation from our bodies and so forth.
It sounds like you said everything but used the word, this buzzword, mindfulness. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I think that the one of the good aspects from mindfulness, one of the great principles that is correct, is that that you want to live in a little bit more like a child again. You really want to drink in the details of what you see, hear, and feel, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the ways that we need to. And then we need to exercise more. We need to actually be making decisions with our brain while we're in action. You know, we spend a large part of our life, you know, sitting on the couch, sitting in a chair, incredibly unnatural acts to spend all of this time sitting on our rear ends and drinking in information from the world without acting on it, mm-hmm. or acting on it only by the movements of our fingers and hands.
We're very passive, and also we're not seeking new things. When we have so much routine in our lives, that doesn't help either, does it?
No new learning or limited new learning. We're largely using skills and abilities we developed as a child and to a large extent operating on automatic pilot. Mm-hmm. And new learning, of course, is absolutely critical on a regular schedule to keep our learning machinery in a healthy state.
Often older people, of course, worry about forgetfulness, about their memory. Talk about that, forgetfulness, memory loss as we age.
Well, that's part of the picture, because when you represent information in the brain, you could say when I don't exercise the brain in which it maintains its high fidelity operations, I'm not really taking in information in great detail anymore. You're basically trying to record information in memory that's represented in a fuzzy or imprecise or incomplete way. So the reason we lose our memories is not because we forget how to remember. It's because the information the brain is trying to record is represented in a sloppy or imprecise way in the activities that are generated in the remembering in the brain.
Mm-hmm, because we're perhaps stressed or we're multitasking too much.
Right. And you can re-refine this processing of information received from listening or received from vision or received from the body. And that's one of the things we do when we try to take people to a brain gym. We're trying to basically re-refine the way they hear or see or feel things in detail again. And when we do that, we see substantial recovery in of their memory.
Ooh, I love that. Brain gym. What happens when I go to the brain gym? Take me there.
Well, you can go to a brain. We have a brain gym that's available that's called Brain HQ, or Brain for Brain Headquarters. You can go there on the internet, and there are things that you can do there for free in which you can see, get a gist of what you would do. But basically what you're up to there is to systematically define your accuracy in receiving information in fast time or in detail as you listen or as you look, and then basically progressively advance your ability as far as you can go in an improving or strengthening direction That's the whole idea, mm-hmm. to recalibrate, to re-encode information so that now you're putting it into a form in which the brain can actually reliably record it for posterity, that is to say, remember it.
And so in the same way that when you go to a gym to work out your body, you should expect when you go to this brain gym that it can be difficult at first.
It's fun in a way, but it's work. You know, it's just like going to the gym. It's effortful and nothing. It's not free. Of course, it takes a substantial amount of effort. Put it another way, Ben, you spend a lot of time letting things go to blazes, and it takes a significant amount of effort to drive significant correction.
Okay. Well, Dr. Merzenich, how do we tell then the difference between a flabby brain that needs to go to the brain gym and work out and that or the sort of forgetfulness and actual cognitive decline that signals something more serious?
Well, first of all, if you have any questions about it in your own mind, if you're worried about the problems, you're worried about it on a level in which it's really deeply concerning you, you should go to a specialist. You should seek medical advice, and we can't really give that here. Mm-hmm. But what I can say is that everyone experiences decline, and you can self-assess yourself by basically determining one index is how fast you are in your operations mentally, or in your making decisions about what it is you just saw or what it is you just heard. Now, it's hard to self-calibrate in the sense that the changes that occur in you can be very slow. And therefore, it might not be very easy for you to recall how fast you are or how accurate you are in relation to somebody of a younger age or when you were of a younger age. But you can calibrate yourself against other younger people amongst you. And when you see significant slowing in your operations, you're very aware that it's taking you longer to deal with a problem or come up with a name or come up with this or remember the instructions to a puzzle or a recipe or whatever. You know, you can self-calibrate to some extent to determine whether or not you have a sort of benign, slow, natural loss or whether it's something you should regard as more serious.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Dr. Michael Merzenich. He's a leading pioneer in the study of something called brain plasticity or neuroplasticity. He's co-founder and the chief scientific officer of Posit Science. That's a company that helps people throughout their lives by providing brain training software that is, I guess, clinically proven to help improve cognitive performance. Dr. Merzenich is also professor emeritus of the University of California at San Francisco. Talk a little bit about, we took our brains to the gym. You right. talked a little bit about that. So what, though, we hear a lot these days about the mind-body connection or the fact that we really shouldn't even separate them into two things as we like to do in the Western world. So what is the connection between jogging, swimming, getting out and hiking, that cardiovascular activity and the function of our brains?
Well, first of all, we were constructed, Ben, to make decisions when we're in action. You know, we weren't constructed to spend all of our time sitting on our keisters, you know, sort of taking in information from the world or responding to it only by, like a little robot, only with our arms or hands in motion. So we're really designed to operate in the real world with our real physical bodies, and I mean all of them. That is to say, no motion so isolated as to only involve hands and fingers, and to make decisions in that setting. So that's the natural way that we've been constructed to learn, acquire, advance in our abilities. And we do way too little of that in our modern life. So one of the things that drives me a little bit crazy is when I hear about people talk about exercise, but the exercise is conducted under ways in which the mind is removed from the enterprise.
So, what do you mean?
Well, let's say I'm going to take the daily walk, but I'm going to wear my headphones, so I listen to my iPod, let's say, and that's taking in information, but it's information in which there's a lack of correlation between what you're seeing or what you're feeling in the exercise that you're doing and the actual movement.
So you may be listening to a fine IPR program on your iPod,
yeah.
but you're disconnected from the countryside.
I'm really sorry I brought this up, now, man.
Because
I also highly recommend that people do listen to those IPR programs. But that's another thing. Just don't do it while you're exercising.
So that divides our brain from our body, you're saying. So what would be an example of how we can keep our mind in tune with what we're doing?
Well, we're designed to be masters of the landscapes in which we operate. We're designed to control and operate within them and with understanding of them. So how many people that live even really, really understand or reconstruct in their brain, have the capability of reconstructing in detail in the brain, the very neighborhood in which they spend all of their days? If you think I'm wrong about this, then just ask yourself, what in detail is there on the street that I live on now? I'm going to reconstruct my mind in detail. Then go look there. And you're going to see all kinds of things there that you don't realize are there because you're not really connected with it. Go two blocks away in your mind and say, well, what's there? And then reconstruct it in detail and then go there. And you're going to see all kinds of things there, absolutely, that you did not see, that you're not even aware of there because you're sleepwalking through life. We're designed to be masters of our environment, and that requires that we drink it in and that we take it in and that we remember it and we know where the lay of the land, as it were. But also, we are designed to be continually monitoring the physical feelings from our body and the relationships of the actions of our body to our emotion. And how much are we into that? Mm. I mean, even when we exercise in the gym, we're not really into evaluating in all of its rich complexity the feelings from our body as it relates to our emotion. And so we disconnect ourselves from that, and we don't have all of the values that come from exercising our brain in maintaining that complex, wonderful relationship between body, brain, and brain and environment.
We have just a few minutes left, but let's make sure we talk about brain injury. We have, of course, many injured troops returning from Afghanistan,
right.
Iraq, traumatic brain injury.
Right.
How might your work in neuroplasticity help injured vets, but also, I guess, diseased brains too?
Right. It's a wonderfully complex question, of course, Ben, but we actually have a large trial that's underway in VA hospitals and in Army medical hospitals now in which we're training veterans, people that have been wounded, with traumatic brain injury from Iraq and Afghanistan, and we know that we can help them to a substantial extent because their brains are plastic. They have relatively broad-ranging deficits because this wounding that comes from being near an explosion or that comes from being knocked in the head with a severe blow or blows can have very widespread, can create very widespread diffuse loss and damage. But almost every domain of loss can be strengthened, can be improved. We can actually drive physical, positive physical and functional change by training in an intensive way. And that's what we're trying to do. And Ben, this applies to almost every chronic neurological condition. As long as the plasticity machine itself is intact and healthy, which it almost always is, you can drive every brain in an improving or strengthening, or you could say in a renormalizing direction. And that doesn't mean that we can cure the complex things in the sense that we can correct every aspect of it. We know how to do that. Yeah, but in almost all of these complex conditions, we are making progress in driving changes that really do benefit, really do help in the recovery of such individuals.
So in the brain, in such a recovery, are we reassigning labor tasks to dormant cells, or what is happening there?
We are absolutely not substituting where things happen or how things happen. Actually, what we're trying to do is to recover normalcy. That is to say, we're trying to recover the brain in place when the brain is intact. Of course, sometimes when the brain is severely wounded, there's lost tissue, there's lost, and then we have to substitute function. But we're actually trying to reestablish normalcy in the brain, and we're trying to do that by driving the brain from the distorted position it's in slowly, progressively, in a corrective direction, in all of the dimensions of the distortion that we can understand, to try to drive as complete a recovery as we can.
My guest this half hour has been Dr. Michael Mrzenik, one of the foremost researchers of neuroplasticity. You'll be speaking tonight at Iowa State University about rewiring the brain, the lecture at the Great Hall of the Memorial Union at Iowa State University, to begin at 8 p.m. The final question is a question about a question. Dr. Mrzenik, one question that you would like answered about the area you study, a burning question that you hope to answer in the years that is very significant in your view?
Well, we want to try to prevent the progression of changes that occur in the brain that results in the catastrophes near the end of life.
Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's is one. Parkinson's disease is the second, an example of a neurodegenerative condition. And we know that these neurodegenerative conditions arise substantially because of the changes that are occurring in the brain that we can reverse. So what we're trying to do is to find a sort of magic combination of strategies in training, or a complete enough combination of strategies in training, so that we can basically forestall or at least delay these end-of-life tragedies. And before I'm done, I'm going to sort out how to – we're going to sort out how to do that, at least to make substantial progress in that direction. And we think we're making progress now. But also the other great, great question that so – we put so much energy and investment in is to try to help individuals with catastrophic developmental disabilities like autism. You know, if we could really crack that nut, really understand how these changes arise and how we could really attack them more effectively so that we could help these children that cannot talk, that are so impaired, so disabled, and so frustrated in the terrible difficulties that they have. If we could just help them, that would be a dream. And that's one of my great goals in life.
Dr. Michael Mrzenik, thank you so much for spending the half hour with us and coming into our studio. We appreciate it.
It's very nice to be with you, Ben.
Reminder once again that Dr. Mrzenik will be speaking tonight at Iowa State University about rewiring the brain in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union at 8 p.m. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.